history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there waiting to be told. Stories that, when you take a little time to listen, might just add to your perspective. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And when we take those steps, we learn a lot. We're educated, we're entertained, and so often we end up inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. The calendar says that Veterans Day weekend has arrived. It's a holiday that exists as a reminder that all veterans, any man or woman who has worn the uniform, regardless of when or where or for how long, they are all worthy of our gratitude. Of course, here at Hometown Heroes, we like to say that every weekend is Veterans Day weekend and that our gratitude certainly should not be limited to just this time of year. A lot of the 75th anniversaries you've been hearing about with regard to World War II and the ones you're going to be hearing about over the next 10 or 11 months have to do with battles on land or sea. But anniversaries of air engagements are a little less clearly defined, and it's not too often they receive the same kind of attention. Today, we're going to hear from three different men who 75 years ago today were facing a very uncertain future as prisoners of war because they had all been shot down on the same day, attacking the same target. We'll learn about it first from a bombardier on one of the 638 B-17 bombers the 8th Air Force launched that day. Dean Whitaker was just a teenager from Southern California, but he became quite familiar with Merseburg, Germany.
Synthetic oil plant at Merseburg was a major target. The Germans were running out of oil in their tanks, and that just didn't have enough to really put out a full effort. And so this target was very special. I think every gun in Germany was at that plant. They'd taken them all from Berlin, and the Air Force was the Luftwaffe was the only place they flew was Merseburg, and it was quite a battle. When I looked ahead and saw the flak, which is the black explosion of 88 millimeter shells going off, I thought, my God, we're going to be lucky to get through this. And we got through it fine. We were hit a few times. All I could tell when you were hit that we could smell the burning hot flak metal going through the ship. And we got out of that fine. And as soon as we were out of that, the Luftwaffe attacked us. The first attack, they always attack from the tail because their 20 millimeter cannon would go further than our 50 caliber machine gun. And so the tail gunner was really busy on that first mission. And I think he shot down one of the planes. One of the fellows said, you got one, over the intercom. And so on the second attack, we were hit really bad. The tail gunner was shot bad. And the waist gunner went back to check on him, and he did. He said he's dead. But that time, we were hit real bad, and the plane was out of control. The pilot gave the word to bail out, and me being the navigator, right by the nose escape hatch, I was the first one out. On the way, before I could go out, I had to release, I wore what they called a flak suit, armor vest, and I couldn't, there's an escape tag on that you pull and it's supposed to be released. Well, it didn't release, and I was fighting that, trying to get that off, and I said, man, I got to get out of here. And, you know, I had a voice kind of, my father had passed away about 8 months before I went in the service, and I thought I heard his voice say, you get out of there now. So I did. I wanted to jump out. I said, I can't wait any longer. I jumped out of the escape hatch of the nose. As soon as I hit the slipstream, it tore the flak suit off, but my parachute was only fastened on one side because I couldn't fasten the other side when the flak suit was on. So here I was fighting all the way down, trying to fasten the other side. And at 28,000 feet, You have no strength. You're just ready to pass out. And so I started entering some clouds at 3,000 feet. And I said, well, I better pull this now, whether it's fastened or not. And I pulled it, and I was floating down, and I could hear shots coming up at me. And the Germans were shooting at me as I was coming down.
And this was fire from their aircraft or from the ground?
Well, that was from the ground. It was civilians in the ground were shooting. They all had guns. And then the odd thing about this, when I was, before I hit the ground, I could hear cheering. And I thought, who the heck is cheering in the middle of Germany? And I just about landed in a German prisoner of war camp that held English prisoners. And luckily, a guard from this camp come running out of the camp and made the civilians stop shooting me. They had their rifles already aimed at me, and so they stopped shooting. And the guard gathered me up and took me into this camp, and the English prisoners of war gave us tea and crumpets. It was really something. Four members of my crew were not that lucky. They landed too far away for this soldier to save them, and they were killed by the German civilians. And they later paid for it when the GIs came in, and they had a trial, and I have the names of all the soldiers that did that, and I think they were executed for doing that.
Well, that's understandable, and I'm just struck. We talk about close calls, and you've already described a couple close calls in the air. But here, out of just the sheer chance of the order in which you get out of the airplane and where you come down, you could have been killed by angry German civilians. Instead, you landed where you were safe.
Yes, it was really safe. Then I did notice when I got down that my parachute was fastened on both sides. And I don't know. I had some help there.
So you have no idea how that other side got fastened?
No, it was done.
You talk about somebody looking out for you. That's a pretty clear indication. But that said, while you didn't suffer the fate that your crewmates did suffer, it was no picnic what you did endure. Where did they take you, and how were you treated?
Well, the SS takes you first to interrogation, and they're the worst of all the German soldiers. The Luftwaffe soldiers were really treated us well, but the SS was terrible, and we were taken to a schoolhouse. It was a pretty big battle that day. A lot of planes shot down, and we filled the schoolhouse with about 8 to 10 flyers, and two of them were shot really bad, and we tried to help them as much as we could, but the Germans would give them no help for the first 2 or 3 days, and we were in this schoolhouse, all of us together, and an incident happened there that I'll never forget. The soldier guarding us, he was a Wehrmacht soldier. He wasn't real bad. And he left to fill up his canteen with water once and left us there. And he locked the door and everything, but he left us by ourselves. And luckily, or unlucky for him, he was eating his lunch at the time. And when he got back, his lunch had disappeared. He says, "Who's ate my lunch?" And nobody said a word. But at least we had a little snack there.
And you didn't have to pay any punishment for that?
No, the German guard, they were halfway civilized. We were gone the next day. The Luftwaffe took us and interrogate us and see where we were from and all that. But and then they threatened to keep us until we told them where we were from and what we were bombing and everything. And we knew that all we had to tell them was name, rank, and serial number. And you tell them that, and that was it. And they were going to keep me in there for this cell we went to, had a single cell, and we were going to have to stay there for until we told them that. And they had an air raid that day on the town. I think it was Regensburg or something. And I watched this air raid from my cell window. Bars, and it was quite a sight. You know, I was a 19-year-old second lieutenant, and I nothing I could tell them that they didn't already know. And so I was only there 2 days, and then they sent me to Stalag Luft 3, which was the permanent camp for American officers. There was quite a movie made about Stalag Luth III.
And that's one of my favorites, The Great Escape. What a classic that is.
When I arrived at the camp, I realized that the camp was ran like an army base. We had a colonel was the head of our base, and it was run very strict. If you wanted to escape, you had to go to the escape committee and tell them your plans and everything and wait. But not many people tried that because it was pretty well guarded.
But after a couple of months there with Russian forces approaching the camp, the prisoners were evacuated from Stalag Luth III and forced to march through the snow to their next destination. They marched and marched for 10 days in brutal winter conditions.
We would sleep in a farm every night that gets a barn, and we'd sleep in the hay. And in the morning, you'd wonder who was in the hay with you because you couldn't see anybody. You're covered up with hay. And we just managed to keep warm.
So then after 10 days, they put you on 40 and 8s and took you to another camp.
Yes, we got in these 48s, and they were so crowded you had to stand. There was no room to sit. There was a few guys who were pretty sick, and we'd make room for them to lay down. One occasion, it's Christmas time, and somebody started singing Silent Night. The whole train caught on to that, and you could hear a trainload of GIs singing Silent Night.
Something tells me that each Christmas now, when you hear that song, you probably go back to that 40 and 8.
Yeah, that's true. It sure reminds you of that occasion, because it was really hard sleeping in those car standing up, and I think we were relieved two times to get out and go to the bathroom, and in those 2 days or 3 days on that train, I don't recall just exactly, but it was an ordeal.
So it was probably a relief when you arrived at your next destination, even though you were a prisoner there.
Yes, we crossed the Danube, I believe it was, and then this got little town of Moosburg. It wasn't a city, it was a town, and we marched through that town, and all the German civilians were hanging out of their window with a swastika. Later on, after we were liberated, we walked by that same town, and all the white flags were out.
That's a sharp contrast, and a very good one on the second half of that. So at this new prison camp, were the conditions the same? Were they worse? And had your morale been impacted at all by all this that you've been through?
No, it was worse. The facilities were bad. We had no place to sleep. They had put up some temporary tents. And the first night, we slept in an old barn that had so many leaks in it. And I tried to find a place to sleep that wasn't getting dripped on. Couldn't find it. Everything leaked. But the next day they took us into temporary tents, and this was so crowded. When you slept, you had to sleep on the floor, and everybody was sleeping on the floor, and there was no room. If you had to get up at night, you had to walk over all these bodies. Unluckily, I had dysentery at the time and had to get up a few times during the night. But this dysentery enabled me to go into sick call, which was a permanent barracks that was run by a pre-med student, an Air Force captain. So he treated me, and I'll tell you a little story about him now. On our liberation, well, the first day we saw this infantry spotter planes coming over and knew they were spotting for the artillery. They sighted us and knew we were there. So I think there was 5,000 American officers in this camp. The next morning, we could hear the tanks. They were really making a lot of noise, rumbling. And every once in a while, they'd shoot some. The Germans, was broken up into the Luftwaffe guards, who treated us decently, and SS troops that were guarding us. Two different type individuals. When they heard the tanks coming, the Luftwaffe soldiers wanted to surrender to us, and they started coming into our camp. There was a road leading to our camp from a cheese plant next to us, and the SS troops started shooting their own soldiers that were coming into our camp. And the road coming into the camp, you could see the bodies of a few of them, and they were shooting up our camp too. And I got into a slit trench we had built, trying to get protected from the shots being fired into our camp. And one of the shots missed me about 12 inches, I guess. It hit the reeds that were supporting this slit trench. As soon as the tank saw the shooting from this tower, they shot it. And boy, that tire just blew to pieces by the tank's guns. All right, then that was in the morning. As soon as everything was cleared out, the tanks came into camp. I have a picture of the soldier, the infantryman, shooting the lock off of the gate to the camp. And behind him came the tanks. Were we ever glad to see them? Then, I don't know what the time was, and then a little bit later, after the tanks, General Patton came in with the tanks. I was in sick bay, which was in the first building, and I was standing at the stoop waiting to greet them. I didn't know he was coming, but he came over to the stoop, to the camp, to the door where I was, and asked me, he says, "How you doing, son?" I says, "Fine now that you're here, General." Well, he was there to see his son-in-law, the medic I was telling you about. It was his son-in-law. His son-in-law got hit by one of these stray bullets, but luckily it had gone through the building and it's pretty well spent. They did carry him out, but he was fine. And so General Patton took him with them and disappeared. Another thing that was quite an occasion for a lot of people, one of the captains on the infantry that liberated us, his brother was in our camp, in the tent, and he was going to really treat him. He took him out and shot a deer, brought the deer back, and was going to really treat the guys in that tent for venison dinner. Well, we all got sick. It was just too strong. We didn't eat much of it, but what there was, we were not used to that. So there was another occasion where that afternoon a donut truck came in, a Red Cross donut truck, if you can imagine that. They didn't have any donuts. You know, we tried to bum some donuts. Oh, no, we already gave away. But one of the Red Cross workers in the donut truck, her husband was in camp, and you should see the reunion.
Sure, when you watched those reunions, you imagined your own.
When we went through New York Harbor and the fireboat come out and sprayed and really celebrated, I felt, well, we're home. Everything turned out so well for me, and I have our God to thank.
That is Dean Whitaker, a resilient ex-prisoner of war who's still going strong in Las Vegas at age 94. It's time for our first break, but when we come back, another man shot down on that mission to Merseburg 75 years ago and his story of survival. This special Veterans Day edition of Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. Do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for far too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I've got to tell you, when it comes to your money, I believe I found a better way with EECU. Take a look at myeecu.org and you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Close to 300,000 members now in 10 different California counties. Put $250 in a savings account and you'll start earning dividends. Who else is going to do that for you? And access? So easy. Over 30,000 ATMs. Free mobile banking. And what I really love is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. In 2013, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 1,000 veterans now have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement EECU takes oh so seriously. Again, the website myeecu.org, or just pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 800-538-3328.
This is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and a special Veterans Day edition of our program, hearing from three men from three different states who found themselves in the very same skies over Merseburg, Germany 75 years ago. In addition to 638 bombers, there were over 600 American fighters in the air on November 2nd, 1944. In total, 76 U.S. planes were shot down, and 481 of those 638 bombers were damaged. It wasn't just the incredible wall of flak protecting the synthetic oil factory in Merseburg, but over 700 German fighter planes in the air as well, including some ME-262 jets that those Allied crews were encountering for the first time. Al Porta was a 21-year-old from Spokane, Washington, a B-17 pilot who cared deeply about his 10-man crew.
They were all great guys. I lost three of them the day I was shot down because I had a fire in Bombay. My number three engine was on fire, and probably my number three tank was also ruptured, and the fuel was flowing into the bomb bays, because when I opened the bomb bay door, the fire just engulfed me. So the only thing I could do was just jump out, because that was my exit for bombing, is to go back through the airplane, see that everyone got out. But I couldn't do that because of the fire in Bombay.
We're talking about November 2nd, 1944, your 17th mission. So you had these 16 missions. Had you had some close calls before that? Had you been shot up a little bit in those first 16 missions?
Yes, I'll give you an example of two of the hairiest ones. About the 12th mission there, my waist gunner got a piece of flak right in the pressure point of his leg. Someone went back. The waist area, and the blood was flowing profusely out of his left leg. So we put a tourniquet on him. It was 40 degrees below zero. He'd lost so much blood by that time that I was afraid he'd lose his leg. So we pulled him into the radio room and put him up on his foot. We had electric muffs that we used to stick our hands into, and it was maybe 10 degrees warmer in the radio room than it was in the waist gunner's position. That was the coldest position of the waist gunner. So then we got back to the cockpit. I pulled the crew, asked him. I said, he's going to lose his leg if we don't get him down where it's warmer. And I'm asking you guys, is this pretty risky? Because we have to hit the deck and go home alone without any fighter escort. And they all voted to hit the deck. So after we hit the deck, I ordered the ball turret gunner and all the other gunners to take their crash position, because I said, if we get attacked, I'm going in. I'm going to crash land the airplane. So fortunately, we didn't get any attacks. And we got a little ground fire. Some of the guys reported some ground fire. Other than that, but that was five hairy hours on the deck.
So you were able to make it all the way back to England flying how low off the ground?
50 feet, maybe.
You know what you just said, but I want to make sure all our listeners understand what you just said. Basically, you're saying here you have the luxury of a formation and fighter escort that you could take all the way home with you, and this guy might lose his leg. Or you could put the other nine lives on board in jeopardy to get him back safely and save that leg. And you guys chose to put your own lives on the line to save his leg.
That's correct.
What did that say to you about the kind of men you had on board?
Well, they were, like I say, they were great. From the day I met them, all of them were eager to fight every day when we had a mission assigned, no arguments, pack their gear and get in the airplane, and away we'd go. And we had another mission. Ooh, that must have been about 14... It was very close to the time that Gorse got injured. And on that mission, as I was forming up over England, I lost the turbo on number two engine. I didn't think that was a reason to abort the mission, so we went on. Got over the target, my number one engine started to run away. The prop control was malfunctioning, so the only way I could control that is with the feathering button. What the feathering button does, When you lose an engine, it feathers a prop, so it reduces drag. But I used it to control the prop. We got the bombs away, and I told the navigator, I says, well, pick it out closest to the our friendly lines, and because we got ahead there, we can't keep up with the formation. He says, okay, turn right about 30 degrees or something like that. I no more turned right, and a piece of flak, I got a flak right in number four engine. So that one was dead. So I feathered number four. So now I'm flying with number one running away, number two turbocharged, which is only about half the horsepower at 30,000 feet. I had one good engine, and number four was feathered. And there again, I says, guys, I can't keep up with the formation. We got to hit the deck. So same procedure, hit the deck, took their crash positions, and got back home.
You described that so calmly, but again, you're a 21-year-old kid with all these other lives that you're responsible for. How nerve-wracking was that to go the rest of the way back to home base? And what were you doing up in that cockpit? Are you clenching your teeth? Are you saying a prayer? Are you closing your eyes? What are you doing?
Not too much. You got your hands full flying the airplane, and you kind of looking out for ground fire, especially when you're close to the deck. And you're concerned about it, but not much I can do about it. I don't have any guns other than a .45 in my shoulder harness that I can use.
That's about a week before you end up being shot down on your 17th mission, but I'm wondering, had that stuff started to wear on you? Did you ever find yourself afraid that each mission would be your last?
I was 21 years old, you know. You're indestructible at 21. I would go into town and hit the bars, nights off. So when I'd come home at night, we had three crews in our hut. Some of them still be up crying. It'd be 2 o'clock in the morning. I'd jump in my bunk and go sound asleep. Like I say, I was too young to have any fear.
And I guess that served you well. Well, tell me about that that 17th and final mission. Your target was Merseburg, Germany?
Everything was pretty normal. Our navigator took us about 30 miles off course. Well, that took us out of fighter protection. So the Germans spotted that right away, and they come up in 109s, and they knocked down 9 of us. There again, helpless, no guns to shoot. I don't know what's going on. I know that they're shooting at the fighters by the vibration of the airplane. When I saw number 3 engine was on fire, feathered the prop, and that didn't stop the fire, and gave the order to bail out. So right after I gave the order, I dropped down to the lower part of the airplane, opened the door to the bomb bay, and it was completely engulfed in fire and burned my face and hands. Slammed the door and jumped out. The hatch is right there. As I was floating down, it was real quiet in the airplane, but as soon as I was out there, I could hear the zoom of the engines and the rattle of machine guns. And the fighters had come to our rescue, the American fighters. I didn't want to get in the middle of that, so I didn't pull my ripcord. There was an undercast, so I waited until I got in the clouds below me before I pulled the ripcord and sailed down.
And you said you got burned in the face, so you could still see okay?
Yes. I had my glasses on, fortunately, so burned my forehead, my cheeks, my nose, and lips.
So as you're floating down, are you looking around to see how many other parachutes are out there, or what are you doing?
Yeah, you're looking all around, and I could see other planes going down. I didn't see our airplane explode, but it exploded. It was reported that it exploded about maybe 10 seconds after we bailed out. No, I said, God, don't let them kill me. And that's what was my prayer on the way down.
Where'd you land? Where'd you come down?
Come down in a little farming community in Blankenheim, Germany. Fortunately, we ran into the Volkssturm, the old guard. The German seniors were not committed to the front lines. They just did police work. We had guards that were that way, and they were very reasonable people. We got along real real good with them. I was very fortunate that they were there because some of the guys got picked up by the SS and they didn't make it to prison camp.
Just about every POW I've interviewed that was a prisoner of war in Europe anyway has told me he was greeted by the same words from the Germans who found him. What did they say to you when they found you?
For you, the war is over.
They were pretty consistent with that. So what's going through your mind? I mean, I'm sure you hadn't planned on being captured and being a prisoner of war.
Pretty much in shock. The pain in my hands and face with no treatment in sight, that was probably the most miserable 3 days I ever spent in my life. We ran into other prisoners, and I couldn't even feed myself. They had to feed me, take me to the bathroom, and I probably was in shock for 3 days. You could say that. I have a good memory of, you know, what we were doing. I remember going to a farmhouse there, and they looked at my hands and shook their heads, and that's all they said. They didn't say anything. I was hoping I'd get some butter or some kind of grease to put on to stop the pain. I couldn't make them understand that. So.
When did you finally get some relief?
About 3 days later at Frankfurt.
Frankfurt's where the infamous interrogation center was. So how'd that go down?
They weren't too hard on me. Name, rank, and serial number. They told me more about myself than I told them.
You're being held by the enemy and dependent on them for medical treatment. How did they treat you? Did you sense some compassion in their medical people?
Yes, absolutely. You know, they took real care of me, good care of me. No painkillers. They put my hands in a purple solution, soaking there, took a tweezer and pulled all the skin off my hands. So that was testy, I knew that they would heal.
Good old gentian violet, huh?
I don't know what it was. Is that what they called it? A disinfectant of some kind. But I didn't get any infection, even after the 3 days. They were swollen bad.
So they take you to Stalag 3A. Tell us where that was and what that journey was like.
Well, that was mostly by train, that we didn't have to walk.
40 and eights?
Yes. The Stalag 3 was filled up with American Stalag 3, so Stalag 3A was for the Australians, New Zealanders, and the English. Some of those guys had been there since the war began, 5 or 6 years. I remember the one groupie on sand. If I'm in this prison camp another year, I'm going to cut my throat.
So did they show you the ropes a little bit?
Oh, yeah. They really told us what was going on. We were interrogated to make sure that we weren't German spies. Of course, the fact that my hands were still bandaged, my face was still bandaged, they pretty much figured that I was an American. We had a good security system. We had a radio. We got the news. We knew what was going on. I was about 210, went down to 150, about 10 pounds a month.
And as those weeks and months go by, were you able to keep your spirits up? Were you starting to get a little hopeless, demoralized? How did that work for you?
I don't think I ever got hopeless because, like I say, we had radios and we knew that it was just a matter of time. In fact, the groupie said, no, we're not going to try to escape because it won't be long. The Americans or the English will be here to liberate us. We just went by the news all the time because just before... maybe 6 months before I got there, they had 3 tunnels dug out of the prison. 66, I think, got out, and they were captured, and Hitler ordered them killed. So they killed 66. So, and then they found the other tunnels, so that was the end of that escapade. So
you knew you weren't escaping. I'm just curious what it was that kept you believing things would be okay? I mean, was it just the strength in numbers with the other POWs? Was it something about your upbringing, your faith? What do you think it was?
I guess it was more or less my upbringing, my faith. Prayed to God every day.
Did your family know you were a prisoner?
They knew I was missing in action. That's all they knew.
What do you think is the worst thing, the most difficult thing that you had to endure?
I think it's psychological. Yeah. It's psychological. You can only get so scared, and then after that, you got to say to yourself, am I going to go crazy, or am I going to get out of this. You know, so you make up your mind right there that you're going to go with the flow, trust in God, that you're going to get liberated without getting killed. That other things to occupy your mind as soon as you are liberated, you know, dwell on that. The only thing that bothers me is losing those three kids. They were 18 years old when I went to the war memorial, and they had the stars for those killed in action. I said three of those stars belonged to my crew members, and little did I know that each star was 100. But I said they deserve one big star.
To finally get back to America and to see your family again and have them realize you aren't dead out there somewhere, you're alive. What was that like for you?
Well, that was really great. My mother was very weepy. She cried all the time. And I'm sure it was her prayers that kept us alive, because I had a brother who was a P-38 pilot, and he finished up his tour in Europe and came home. Another brother was in the 1st Marine Division. He made three landings in the South Pacific, and he came home alive. So we all said it was her prayers that brought us all back alive.
Al Porta passed away in 2013 at the age of 90, but he touched so many lives, including many fellow veterans in his retirement years as he volunteered at the VA in Reno, Nevada. We're not done yet with this Veterans Day edition of Hometown Heroes. When we come back, another man who spent Armistice Day 75 years ago praying an armistice would come quickly in World War II. His story is one you can read about in a book, and I'll tell you more about it when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this. Have you ever looked at a box of old videotapes or photos and said, one of these days I'm going to do something with those? I know the feeling. But more importantly, I found the solution at VHSmaster.com. VHS Master will take all your old VHS and 8mm tapes and reels and convert them to DVDs and digital videos, ensuring that your priceless memories will last for years to come. They'll even preserve and restore photos, slides, and audio cassettes. Go to VHSmaster.com. That's VHSmaster.com. And tell them you heard about them on Hometown Heroes.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes with this special Veterans Day edition, taking us back 75 years through the eyes of three men who were dealing with plenty of pain and a whole lot of uncertainty 75 years ago this week. They had all been shot out of the sky on November 2nd, 1944 in a massive mission to Merseburg and the synthetic oil factory there. If you go to hometownheroesradio.com, you'll find a photo giving you a little taste of the flak-filled skies produced by 1,700 German anti-aircraft guns in Merseburg. 38 B-17s were shot down that day, another 450 damaged. We've heard from a bombardier from California and a pilot from Washington. Now let's hear from a tail gunner out of Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Frank Kravitz had just turned 21 a couple weeks earlier and soon would have reason to fear he might never see 22.
Well, we took off at 8 o'clock, about 8 o'clock in the morning. By the time we got rendezvous, our poop, and got in position for this bombing stream going to our target, we flew around at different altitudes, and we're just going around and around and around, you know. And once we got to 15,000 feet, where we went on oxygen, we were getting close to France or something like that, you know, where the Germans were. And we weren't on oxygen up till then. The anticipation comes when you see the black smoke coming up, if it's flak, you know. And somebody else ahead sees that, so they're telling us, you know, enemy fire up ahead, you know, so you got over 1,000 bombers in the air, a stream going in, you know. Yeah. So, unfortunately, when our pilots, they opened the bomb bay doors and get ready for attack, and that, you know, we dropped our bombs, and we turned off the target, and shortly after we turned off the target, we were attacked.
When you say attacked, you're not talking about the flak anymore. You're talking about German fighters coming right at you, and you saw them? Did someone else tell you they were coming, or were you the one who saw them?
3 o'clock high. Yeah. You know, saw them coming.
How many of them?
Three abreast, you know. And I saw the cannon fire coming out of the wings for the last seconds, you know. And I fired back at them when I was still alive, you know.
And you shot one of them down?
I got credit for it. Somebody else in the other crew said that the tail gunner shot down a plane. So that I have the citation for that, you know. Okay, when the second wave of planes came in, I was had my target on the planes, and all of a sudden there was an explosion in the tail end of the section, and it filled up with smoke. And, of course, being at that high altitude and the holes that were in the plane and everything else, the air cleared up real quick. So there I am, realized that I was wounded. I got on my throat mic, and I called to the crew pilot, tail gunner crew, I'm hit. I'm pushing on the button, the throat mic, and trying to report to them. I get no answer. As it half find out later on, this was all shot out, the whole communication system. So when they were, the only way they communicated up front, the flight engineer were hollering back into the plane as loud as they could, giving orders and what to do. They chopped out the, this told me just later on, they got a hatchet and chopped the ball turret out and dropped that, threw all the ammunition out. They were throwing the ammunition out and everything to lighten the plane up, you know.
Because you guys had lost three of the four engines, right?
Yeah. So this I wasn't aware of, but after our reunions and that, I was told about it, and another fellow had a video camera when we were doing it, and they all pitched in, and I had that document, which helped me write the book. They filled in the blank spaces that I, at that time, didn't know, you know.
Yeah.
My waist gunner, we came to a crossroad going down the road towards the farmhouse, and he's got his hands over his head with a German guard with a rifle on his back, you know. And I was on a two-wheel cart that they had gotten a picket fence and put it across the two-wheel cart, and that was my stretcher. So they're marching him down, marching me down to the place, and then we come to another place, and they took him one place, and they took me to the farmhouse.
But I think maybe we missed some important details. You were wounded pretty seriously, so how'd you manage to get out of the plane?
Well, my radio operator and another fella both have me laying on the floor, and they put sulfa powder on my wound, bandaged it, and put a big compress on it. Did stop the bleeding, you know.
And this is your left thigh, and you still have shrapnel in that left thigh, right?
Over 100 pieces.
I bet you're fun to go through a metal detector with.
That was an interesting story, too. My wife and I took them to some of her relatives that moved to California, so we took a trip to California. So I took my wife and three kids on a plane ride to California. We get off at LAX airport, and I let the children go through, and I let my wife go through, then I go through. As soon as I passed, the thing, bells went off, and horns were blowing, and everything else, you know. And my family's waiting for us to greet them, you know. Two guys grabbed me by the arm, would you step back and go through again? So I stepped back, and I went through again. Now they really grabbed me and took me off to the side, you know. I says, what are you doing? What's wrong with me, you know? And my cousins out there, put them in jail. Put them, just, they were stupid. We laugh about it all the time. Yeah. But they took me to a little room, and they asked me to strip and everything else, you know. Yeah. I says, what are you looking for? I says, I don't have no pistols or guns or nothing, you know. You know, he says, well, you're ticking off the thing. I says, how about the shrapnel in my legs? So I says, I'll drop my legs here. I got over 100 pieces in my legs. Say, so put the thing up there, and that's what it was. Uh-huh. Yeah, but now things are more sophisticated.
I'm sure your kids remembered that too.
It's that damn well, what cops to them with their dad.
Well, you dealt with much worse interrogations than that, I know too. And I want people to understand what the situation is here. So you're on this airplane that is barely making it, that is not gonna make it, and there's a real chance you aren't going to make it. You're wounded severely. You can't get yourself out of this plane, so you needed your fellow crew members to save your life, right?
After they dragged me through from the tail of the ship into the radio room, which was like a cabinet, you know, so that they could talk, and you didn't have the noise in here in the radio room, you know. So when I was on the floor, they looked at my wound and everything, put sulfa powder on it, made compresses on it, you know, wrapped it real tight, and gave me morphine and other sedatives. It was in the first aid kit, you know. And I was awake.
What was going through your head?
I had no idea. I didn't the thing is, as things were happening, and I'd say to myself, all I was doing there is trying to remember what's going on, unconsciously, you know, observing everything that's going on. And that's why I have such a vivid picture of it. What's ahead, I don't know. It's just happening there. You're looking at it, and I remember it, you know.
So you couldn't walk. You couldn't bail out yourself, and the captain's given the order to bail out, right?
Yeah, the captain gave the order to bail out, and they took care of me first. And they got me over to the door, put the chute on me, popped the chute in the floor, and put it in my arms and tossed me out. I just didn't take long for the chute to open up, you know. I'm quite a jolt, by the way.
Well, yeah, so they actually pulled the ripcord before they pushed you out of the plane. So then it's opening immediately when you pop out of that plane.
Yeah. It was happening. I wasn't thinking about it. I guess my mind was just recording it, that's all.
So you had a pretty long way down to the ground. Were you conscious? Were you looking around you? What did you see?
At first, I thought I was going up. You know, and honest to God, I thought, geez, this thing's going up, you know. And then all of a sudden, the ground started coming up to me, meet me, you know. And then there were dwellings around the area, and there was farms and everything else. So I remember that, you know. Then after I landed, I know where it was, you know. And I have one member of my crew that went over later, many years later, and he documented where our plane went down. Then when we had reunions, I had another fellow brought his video camera, and they all talked around, and we have a video of that, you know.
While all this was going on, did the thought enter your mind that you might not wake up another day, that this might be it for you?
No. I didn't think about death then, you know. I just was observing what's happening at now. That was the only thing I was interested in.
And what happened when you hit the ground?
I tumbled like a jackrabbit. I tumbled down the hill.
Yeah.
A few steps like that, because it was on a little hill like this, and I just boom, 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 boom. You know. I know their instructions were to hold your feet up in this, let you get, easier said than done, you know, especially if you're wounded, you know.
Yeah.
I wouldn't even think of that, you know.
Well, and I've talked to some POWs who tried to hide or avoid capture. Most of them, you know, maybe they lasted a few hours, but they were eventually captured. And in your case, there wasn't much you could do because you couldn't move unless you dragged yourself with your arms, huh?
Yeah. I had no motion at all. I had to be on a stretcher or a bed somewhere, and that was it, you know.
Who found you? What did they say to you?
There were two German members of the Wehrmacht, like sad sacks, you know. Not very neatly dressed, or, you know, they were doing a job, that's all they were doing.
But there was another situation here where somebody saved your life because there were some civilians you'd been bombing that wanted to take your life, right?
The civilians were coming in a distance, and they came close enough that I saw they had pitchforks and that in their hands, and that, and they threw, Germans fired a couple rounds, and they went back to where that house was that they eventually took me anyway, you know. Took me to the farmhouse where the Hitler Youth took care of me. You know.
So that night, you spent the night in a cow barn, unable to move, guarded by two members of the Hitler Jugend. I can't imagine what that felt like. And even after they got you to a hospital, you don't know how much they really want to take care of you. You don't speak their language. And there was a real fear that you might lose your leg.
Well, I said when I lay was on the table, and the flying nun that was just attending to the doctor, you know, the thing in the table wasn't more than 3 feet wide and about belly high, you know, where I was laying on, maybe chest high or right here, and none was looking straight at my face, you know. I don't know what the procedure was, but I know they put a container on my nose and told me to count, and I remember counting to about 100.
You wanted to know if they were going to cut off your legs, so you motioned?
And then none was beside me, and I made motions with my hand if they were going to amputate, and then none says nine. I already knew because my mother spoke German, so different words that I didn't know from that, you know. And I just had no thoughts more, but somebody's taking care of me, do with me what thou wilt.
But when you came to after that operation, what was the first thing you did?
Well, I took my hand, started my hip, and went down the side and see if I still had a leg. Because I thought the Germans were historically, amputations were the easiest way out. So that's what had happened, and I went down my leg, and it's like that, and they patched me up the best they could, and I don't know what the drugs they used on me or anything else, but they comforted me enough that a couple of days later I was taken on a train to the interrogation center in Dulagluft for down fires.
So they didn't amputate, they took care of you. So here you have a situation. A, the civilians basically have a lynch mob and they want to take you out, and these German guards shoot their gun in the air to save your life. And then these medical professionals save your leg and get you fixed up. Looking back now, how does that make you feel to know that these people on the other side of the war, your enemies, took such good care of you?
Well, I think later finding out that because we had been taking care of down German flyers, bringing them to the United States and taking care of them, they know what they got in the United States, German flyers here in the country, what good service they were getting, you know. I think that reflected back to us where we didn't get treated as miserable. What do you call it, camaraderie between flyers? Yeah, you know. So that prevailed.
So you spent a lot of time just healing up, but then you still had to spend time in a couple different prisoner of war camps. I know you were about 175 pounds or so when you went into the service.
When I signed up, I weighed 175 pounds. I had to be 170 to get into the Air Force. So I went back to my football coach, went down to the football field, and I worked out with a football team, you know, during the summer with him. My stepmother's angry at me because I'm not eating. I don't want to eat. I just went on a diet, and I was determined I'm going to get in the Air Force, and I'm going to lose this weight, and I'm going to get in. So I did, you know.
A little more than a year after you were losing weight to get in the service, you were starting to lose weight, not by choice, because as a prisoner, you just didn't have much food. What was the worst of that? What was the hardest thing to deal with that element of your captivity?
Well, example to that is, I'll put it this way. One day, I was out there. They put me in an upper bunk because I'm not going to be ambulatory for a long time. They brought another down flyer in a bed next to me. We had our pleasantries, and he was in bad shape and everything else, you know. But we brought our food out. It was meager as it was, you know. I ate it, you know. And he's screaming, "I can't eat this crap," you know. I says, "Well, what are you going to do with it, you know?" He says, "You want it?" I says, "Yeah, I'll take it." They passed it over to me, and I ate it. You know, a couple of days of that, no more food came over. he needed it. You know, but that was a part of it. I said, "Give me all you got." You know, yeah. But after my hospital visit, they had, like I said, the food parcels that they confiscated, and they used them for themselves and for us.
So the Red Cross would send parcels, but it didn't all make it to you guys, the prisoners.
They did meagerly. In fact, every parcel that they brought to the hospital, they punctured it. So if you had meat and beans in there, boom, you had to eat it within a couple of days, you know. So the idea was to hoard those things that you're going to last longer, sugar, coffee, chocolate bars. You start eating small pieces of it, you know.
Did you ever think of escaping?
No, I don't think I ever did. With that many people, you know, guns are there. They're going to open fire on you. But first of all, there was a 10-foot warning wire inside and a 20-foot wire outside and barbed wire in that empty space. Now, many of the guys lost their life by trying to get through that maze because they got fired on right away anyway. And then the tunnel bit and everything else. I didn't see any of that kind of stuff. But it's historically, they did dig tunnels.
And how much did you weigh when you were liberated?
118 pounds.
So all these months, you're wasting away. You don't have enough to eat. You don't know when the war is going to be over or that your side's going to win. What gave you hope? Where did that come from? How did you believe that there was still a life out there for you?
I believe in the good Lord would take care of me. It's all whatever becomes of me. You never thought you were going to die for that matter, you know. You're living, so you live. And who knows when you're going to die anyway, you know.
Your wife told me about a really unorthodox way the doctors decided to fight infection in your wounds to help save your leg. What was that all about?
Well, when I was first taken to the hospital, they put the maggots on my... What was the question again?
So your wound was infected, and they used maggots.
Right. That's the first thing they did. After maggots were in there, I'm under a sheet tent, like, you know, so it wouldn't be touching the operation. Then all of a sudden, I could lay on my back with a pillow maybe that big, and, you know, I'm looking up, and every other day or so, that the British mortars, the doctors were looking at it, and then when they finally come, rinse it off because it turned white, now they start cleaning the wound. And then they started the operation of taking skin from my rear end, and we put them in some kind of fluid and that, and put it on my wound, and it coagulated on my wound. And that's the skin grafting I had.
This is really serious stuff that you had to deal with. And I guess there's another instance. We talked about your crewmate saving your life and the German saved your life. I guess the maggot saved at least your leg?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. You know, there's a funny thing about that, too. When I come home, I started maybe up at the VFW or wherever I was. I joined the VFW right away, yeah. And everybody's talking. Isn't it? And one of my other friends was a POW, you know, and they hear us talking about having these maggots taking care of our wounds, you know. And he says, oh, you guys are full of crap. They don't use maggots, you know, on things. And actually made a joke out of it and everything else. I resented the fact, you know.
Yeah.
You know, I resented it. I said, okay, I'll shut my mouth. You're going to be that way. Nobody's going to believe me anyway, so, right? You know, so I shut my mouth. I didn't tell my parents. I didn't tell anybody about how they took care of it, you know. Many years later, and I can't say it was 10, 15, or 20 like that, there was an article in the Pittsburgh Press, a big spreadsheet, not talking about military. A doctor up in one of the towns north of me is using maggots for certain wounds in that, you know. Mm-hmm. I cut that sucker out so fast, put it in my pocket, you know, and anybody ever mentioned it again, I tell you, here. You know, I tell you, my pro-wife probably didn't just believe it. So, so it's so far-fetched. Yeah. Nobody knows about that, you know.
And it's not one you want to tell at a dinner party, I suppose. It might turn a few stomachs.
But those are just the tidbits that are true. That's all I know how to say. That's true.
Well, and obviously the fact that we're sitting here talking, and the fact that that you have three children and five grandchildren, none of them would have been here if you didn't make it through all this, if you didn't survive, if you weren't eventually liberated. And sounds like there's a pretty good story about the day of your liberation and some things that you saw that you'll never forget. This was in Moosburg, Germany?
Well, I arrived at this camp from our long march from Nuremberg to Moosburg, Germany.
How long was the march?
90 kilometers. It took us about 15 or 16 days to walk, you know.
With anything to eat or no?
Yeah, we had whatever we could scrounge, you know. People, there were Germans that had potatoes, and somebody had something, could barter with them. Well, and whatever we saved to go on the trip, that we had in the sack to sustain us, you know.
You're in Nuremberg, and you marched 16 days to Moosburg.
And when we got inside of Moosburg, it was already crowded from other camps being vacated, and the things, us men coming in, the prisoners coming into the same compound. So it ended up, historically, it says that they were over 100,000 all nationality prisoners of war, Germans, French, whatever, at this camp. And on April 29th, our senior officer in charge of the United States Army that were opposing the Germans that were protecting their prisoners, and they were about to release them, they sent a group to the German groups there, they had white flags and that. They come back, and the Germans refused. They're going to attack the camp. So, and we didn't know this, but that's historically what it was, you know. So it was about 9 o'clock in the morning on April 29th that the fire started. Our tanks start coming down over the hill. We saw them, and then all kind of vehicles, you know, and so much fire, you know, was going. And I guess the confrontation lasted maybe about an hour and a half. And our people inside says, lay on the ground, get under the barracks, get it done, because the fire's going on. And you're just hoping. They're shooting at our troops, and we're getting the residuals of it, you know, from in the air, you know. Some fellas were hurt, you know, from it, you know. Shortly before noon, we saw the flag go up over Mooseburg.
And when you say a flag, this is somewhere where there had been a swastika flying, but the new flag was?
American flag.
Yeah.
Yeah. So then all the shouting and everything was going on, you know. And it wasn't shortly after that that Patton, our troops came up to the gate, and then Patton came, followed in right away and rode up on his big white tank, you know. Not white tank, but he looked like God anyway.
White gloves and pearl pistols, I'm sure.
Mayhem, you know, tears, you know, kissing ground and everything, hugging and everything else. And it's very... So I said, we're going home. Everything we could think about. And it didn't take long, though.
Just imagining or seeing in your mind's eye that American flag going up and Patton's forces coming through the gate brings all those emotions back for you, doesn't it?
Yes. How the good Lord took care of me, brought me back home. There's things that you're going to experience in your life. They're very traumatic, but there are more things that are happy. So you don't dwell on the sadness and everything else. There's solutions to all things like that, sadness, you know, and some good might even come out of them, you know. But don't dwell on it because you'll ruin yourself.
I know you believe that God had a plan for you, and speaking of, I forgot to ask you about one other thing you did in the prison camp that I know you've reenacted for your kids. Tell us what your POW ingenuity led you to craft out of a few pieces of string.
Being a Catholic and raised a Catholic and grade school and everything else, you know, and we learned to pray the rosary. And naturally, we had our prayer books and rosaries, military rosaries with us. And when the Germans took them off of us, sorry, they were ours, no secret. The other people did it too. So I followed suit and made a rosary and used them to sustain my faith. And my prayers were to make me healthy and return to my family. And dedicate myself to that. You know, I told the dear Lord, if I let me get out of this predicament that I'm in, I'll never complain in my life. And I've done that.
And he kept doing that until his final breath in 2015 at the age of 91. Frank Kravitz's book, 11-2, is linked for you at hometownheroesradio.com. So those are the stories of just three of the more than 300 Americans shot down over Merseburg 75 years ago. Just imagine what stories we never got to hear. Another reason to engage the veterans in your life and encourage them, when they're comfortable, to share some of their stories with you. I promise you'll understand even more clearly those four words we close with every time. Thanks so much for listening to Hometown Heroes today. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free. If you spent much time listening to Hometown Heroes, you've probably heard veterans from all over America talking about the mission of the Honor Flight Network, taking World War II veterans free of charge to see their memorial in Washington, D.C.
I wanted to see it. I've always wanted to see it since they built it. And to see all those guys there that did survive, and then they get emotional. Pretty soon you get emotional, too.
I tell you, that honor flight, I just can't believe what a wonderful deal it is.
Everywhere people came up to us, military guys and civilians, and wanted to shake our hands and thank us for all we did. I kept saying there were 16 million of us, you know, and I only did a little piece. But it was just an emotional high.
When it comes to our men and women in uniform, all gave some, and some gave all. A reality underscored as veterans visit the World War II, Korea, and Vietnam memorials and Arlington National Cemetery.
All those white crosses, they go into your heart. You just know that there's good guys there, but they had to die. For what? So you could live.
And while they are still living, Honor Flight gives the rest of us a chance to express our gratitude. Won't you encourage the World War II veterans in your life to put in applications for this all-expenses-paid journey to their memorial?
It does something for each of us who have been veterans who go back, whether we're a guardian or whether we're honored as a guest on the flight. It completes our life, really. Gives us a sense of fulfillment that we weren't able to have before, I think.
If you live near me in Central California, find Central Valley Honor Flight at cvhonorflight.org. Wherever you're listening, there's a hub in your area, and you can find it on the national website, honorflight.org. Sign up a veteran, volunteer to help, or donate to this important and time-sensitive mission. It's amazing what it means to these members of our greatest generation.
I'm telling you, they make you feel so good and so wonderful. Let me tell you, I can't preach enough about this. You listening?
The manner in which we were treated and greeted and acted toward was just awesome. It made me believe that the people of the United States are just wonderful.
Time is of the essence. Team up with Honor Flight today and help give our veterans one more tour with honor.